Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 745 of the podcast, and it is Sunday, the 7th of April, 2024, as I record this. In today's show, I have a discussion with Rachel Herron about fear of the unknown, fear of judgment, fear of failure, and how we keep writing and creating despite all of this, as well as how to get unstuck in your book and your life. So that's coming up in the interview section. So in publishing industry things, no news in particular, but something tangentially related to our industry. So we watched BlackBerry, the dramatisation of the story of the BlackBerry, the handheld device which ruled the world before the iPhone. And those of you who are my age and older will remember it. Everyone had their CrackBerry at one point. And it's a really excellent film. It demonstrates how time changes things because, of course, a lot of it's based in the 90s, the early 2000s, and how technology moves on and what happens when one particular technology, in this case the iPhone, completely upends what people thought was going to happen. Also, why you can't hang your future on something you invented or something you did or something you wrote a decade or so ago. You have to keep reinventing yourself and your company. The main characters really demonstrate the issue of being stuck in the old ways and not seeing how things have changed. And I'm pretty sure you'll see the parallels in our industry. Another thing that struck me was the value of intellectual property. As BlackBerry, the company, not the devices, the company still exists today and specialises in cybersecurity. Now, what is particularly interesting is that they have over 42,000 patents, many of which are core for mobile technology and software applications because they were so early in the space. Now, patents are intellectual property for specific inventions, and copyright is another form of intellectual property. So again, I look at this and I go, wow, having intellectual property really keeps the value of something even when one particular product disappears. And I, in fact, when I was looking at this, I saw they just sold a package of non-core patents, so patents that aren't even the really valuable ones. They sold them for $900 million. And also, I had a look at the founder, Mike Lazaridis, who was originally this incredibly visionary technologist, founder, engineer, who first thought to put a keyboard on a cell phone and figured out all kinds of early technology. If you watch the movie, it's really interesting. And he's now heavily into quantum computing. So eventually, when he left being CEO of the company, and you'll see that in the movie, but he pivoted back once more into future tech. So really interesting movie to think about. And I had a couple of questions for you based on that I've been thinking about. Number one, are you holding on to a vision of what the industry used to be 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago? And this is true for indie authors just as much as traditionally published authors or those who want a deal. How can you let go of the past so you can move into where we are now and where we are going? And secondly, do you understand the value of your books and stories as intellectual property assets? When I even say the phrase intellectual property assets, do you know what that means? Have you spent time understanding copyright and why it's important? Do you own a copy of The Copyright Handbook by Stephen Fishman? And have you read it? To be fair, I read it a few years ago, and you don't sit down and read it, you dip in and out, but I should probably have another go through that. But it is a fascinating book. Also, I think this is more important than ever in this age of generative AI, because I see some people saying things that are frankly wrong based on copyright law. A lot of the copyright law is similar across the world, but also it is different. So, for example, the UK copyright law around AI is very different to the US copyright law. So don't assume that things are the same everywhere. So yeah, interesting times. Now in AI news, I guess, and talking of adapting to changing technology, the book I would recommend this week is Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI by Ethan Mollick, which just came out this week and I've almost finished it. He is an associate professor at the Wharton School in Innovation and Entrepreneurship. Now it is a more pragmatic book. He is not a super, super tech guy, so I think it's pretty accessible. It has not got the overly technical language you get in a lot of books on AI. I follow Ethan on X and also his Substack. I think he is pretty good, you know, sort of middle, straight down the line, as opposed to over emotional, over positive, or over dramatically doomer. I mean, we all need to learn how these technological changes might affect us. And he also presents various forms of evidence about the benefits. For example, early studies of the effects of AI have found it can often lead to a 20 to 80% improvement in productivity across a wide variety of job types, from coding to marketing. And I certainly find this, and I use ChatGPT-4 and Claude 3 Opus, particularly for all kinds of things, not just my author business, I should say. We had a blinking light on a device this week, took a picture, uploaded it to ChatGPT and diagnosed the issue. I've also, because we're into spring here, I took a picture of my tired looking garden and said I need cat friendly plants to go in the borders. I also got it. This is a really crazy one, right? I've got this gas box outside our front door and it's just covered in stuff. And I was like, I need the right product to clean this and not damage the material. And again, it gave me that recommendation. So you can upload photos and things and have it diagnosed. Oh, I'm working with ChatGPT-4. I'm trying to get into wheel pose in yoga, if you understand what that is. It's like a back bend. And there are lots of things you can do to work towards that. You can't just go from not doing a back bend to doing one. You have to work into it. So I've started doing that too. So you don't have to use this for your writing stuff. You can use it for life. But yes, Claude 3 Opus is amazing for writing sales descriptions. I've also just got it to help with my Kickstarter pledge levels, different ideas, and a 21-day marketing plan. Just love it. So yes, have a go. But if you're still on the fence about AI or you are open enough to read a book, then Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI by Ethan Mollick, M-O-L-L-I-C-K. So in personal news, the reason I'm recording this late is because I have been super tired because I pitched Catacomb last Friday at the London Screenwriters Festival to producers and directors, executive people in the movie industry, live in person. So Catacomb I pitched it as a horror movie set in the catacombs under Edinburgh, based on my novella, yes, you guessed it, which is called Catacomb. So just sort of going back a few years, I went through a phase of screenwriting. I've written a few screenplays. I did a course at the National Film and Television School, the NFTS, in 2018. I did that, and I have a pretty long episode, solo episode, on lessons learned from that, which I'll link to in the show notes, or you can just look for screenwriting, but I'll link to this in the notes. At the end of that course, it was a sort of bring your draft and write your draft and workshop it. And then at the end, you got to pitch to an agent. And I pitched what my project at the time, which was Matt Walker's, an adaptation of Map of Shadows into a feature film. And he said, great ideas, blah, blah, blah. Way too expensive. That film is a huge budget movie. Not going to happen. Now, of course, these days, things have changed in terms of the effects. But he suggested at the time, write a cheap horror movie. And what's amazing about horror movies is that some of the most profitable movies have been the cheaper horror movies that have gone on to make a lot of profit. Where, of course, some of these massive budget movies don't make a profit. I had the idea for this book, Catacomb, over a decade ago when I toured the Edinburgh Catacomb. So this is one of these long-term sort of ideas that's bubbling away in my head, like many of us. I have all these ideas bubbling in my head, and then at some point one of them emerges. This to me is being a discovery writer. At some point the idea bubbles up and it stays at the top of the bubbling pot. whatever. So anyway, last year, I finally wrote Catacomb, and the emotional heart, it's basically a father-daughter movie. The emotional heart is a father who will do anything to save his daughter. And if you remember the final scenes of Armageddon, the sacrifice of a father for his daughter, or the kind of vibe of Liam Neeson in Taken, that's what I was looking for. And I did write it as a screenplay, but let's face it, I'm not a screenwriter. That is not a job I want to do. I rather write books and then license them, license that IP. So I just decided to pitch the book. So I did a lot of preparation. I've been working with a freelance producer to hone the pitch package, which is a sort of, if you think of a PowerPoint slide deck, essentially, with images and comparison titles and characters and world elements and themes and plot and how much money the comparison titles made, that kind of thing. So I made that deck, and of course a bit about me and about my other IP that I have. So I did all this preparation. I practiced the pitch. I was super, super nervous, obviously. But my definition of success, as I've said on this show, a couple of months ago I mentioned I was doing this, and I said my definition of success was going, actually turning up and actually pitching. So I won the day, and there was a moment about two-thirds of the way through, so it was a three-hour session, and about 2 hours in, I went outside and I was like, I can't go back in. My head was banging, and I was like, I just can't go back in there. And then I was like, nope, I'm here. I've put all this work in. I've got time for maybe two more pitches. Let's just see. And I went back, and actually the first pitch I did after that break went super, super well. So there you go. But in terms of the actual event, just to tell you a bit more about it, it's a paid 3-day festival. So the London Screenwriters Festival, you can look it up, or I'll link it in the show notes. There were around 80 creative people, mainly screenwriters, pitching within the 3 hours, and there were only about 18 executives. So you had to queue up for each one, and a bell would ring after 5 minutes. So it was kind of speed dating for story ideas. So as I mentioned, as film and TV people are visual people, I made a pitch deck. And of course, an image can tell you a lot about the genre and all this kind of thing. So I'm really happy I took A5 sized postcards. Now, obviously, I have this online as well that I can send to people, but it's I took postcards, which helped me stay on track as well. I also had a 3-page outline ready to go, which I had some printed as well as an online link. I pitched 5 executives in 3 hours, which was about all that was possible because of all the queuing. I am sharing that pitch package and my 3-page outline with my patrons. So if you are a patron, that should be out just after this goes out. You can download those as examples, obviously for your personal usage. Do not randomly share with other people. It is my IP. But yes, happy to share that with my patrons at patreon.com/thecreativepen. So yeah, in terms of pushing my comfort zone, I absolutely pushed my comfort zone with this one. I was so tired when I got home. Going to London for the day is quite a big day out. Anyway, you know, not much sleep because I was nervous. Got on the train, got there, and then the nervous energy, that kind of adrenaline spiking for several hours, and then the room was so noisy. All those people in quite a small room, you know, it was hot. Just the whole thing was hard, and I was broken afterwards. Yesterday I had to spend the afternoon in bed, but it was so worthwhile, so worthwhile. So I wanted to both tell you how hard it is and also how worthwhile it is. So I learned a few things I thought I would tell you. First of all, having a book to pitch as opposed to a screenplay actually was a genius move, because I really stood out and they were completely fine with it. And in fact, when I said, also, look, I don't even need to be involved. I want to license the IP. I don't need to be involved in the production. They're kind of, their eyes lit up. And having the book there, I didn't give the book to anyone, but it was like, look, this is evidence. This is a representation of my ideas in physical form. Because what I found, and I talked to a few people in queues and things, most people I talked to did not have a finished product, whereas I clearly had a finished product. So that was interesting. I also had my other books and series on postcards, and several of the producers said that I looked prolific, and which is not a word I use for myself. So that was an interesting reframe for me. None of them asked about my publisher. So if anyone's like, oh, but what if you're an indie author? Doesn't matter. They literally did not mention it, ask nothing, nor did they ask about sales. It was literally the story concept they were interested in. I'm also really pleased I had my pitch deck, because for 5 minutes you have to be so succinct. I also researched who I wanted to pitch, and this was advice from that course I mentioned a few years ago. Pitching has two sides to it: the pitcher, which is you, and the catcher, which is them. It is not all about you. It is also about them. Who are they and what do they want? So make sure they want what you have. Otherwise, it's just a waste of time. So 3 of the execs I pitched did specifically want horror based in the UK. So I knew that going in, and that was a good fit. Now, to be clear, I have no expectations about any kind of outcome from this. It's like people say, oh, well, then I'll look forward to coming and seeing the movie like next year. Nope, that's not how it works. I mean, for even massive sellers like Lee Child with Jack Reacher, took decades to get made. So this is not, it's not like I'm expecting to get a movie deal next week. But one of my, of course, I'm open to opportunities, and I've put it out to the universe that that will happen. But it's not like that's what I'm not waiting for the phone call or not doing anything else. But one of my goals is to have one of my stories adapted to film or TV. And this felt like a good restart to that goal. Obviously, the pandemic happened, but I'd kind of put that aside thinking, well, if I don't want to do screenwriting, then I can't pitch. But now I understand that I can. It's really good. I have so many ideas. Super, super, super tons of ideas. So my plan is to keep writing standalones, which I really do like feature films. And so I think that's what I'm focusing on, standalone that make feature films, get to know people in the industry, keep writing, keep building up relationships. So I wanted to encourage you, if you want to pitch a book, pitch for a book deal with an agent or a publisher, or if you're pitching for film and TV, if you do your research and if you are prepared and if you make sure your pitch has the commercial aspects included and you're clear around genre and market fit, you will be so far ahead of the other people doing this. I was so surprised by how many people could not tell me what genre their work was in. Literally, I talked to lots of people who said, oh, I'm pitching, it's a film, but I'm not really clear on the genre. And I just thought, how can you have 5 minutes to pitch this person? How do you not know what genre it is? So that was fascinating to me. And of course, we talk about this in the author space, but it's just as true in film and TV. So anyway, if you do this research, then take some painkillers for the headache. Except that it will be difficult and that you will find it hard, but that it will be worth it, and then go do it. So that's my encouragement. And of course, I'd love to hear from you if you're someone who does pitch, or if you are in film and TV, or if you this is something that, or if I'm completely wrong, if you think I'm wrong and you have experience in this, let me know. I do find this an absolutely fascinating area. I do write very visually. It's funny, I was listening to someone, actually, I think it was Rachel Herron, who said she can't clearly see things in her mind's eye. And I think some other people have been on this show, same thing. I see everything like a film. That's how I write. I see it in my mind and it kind of scrolls away. I don't have a soundtrack. Some people hear voices and all of that. I don't have that, but it's so interesting. So that was the big thing this week. But in other big things, Spear of Destiny is finally with Kristen, my editor. And I also finished the extended author's note on all my research. And I am planning on doing an author's level in the Kickstarter, which will include a 2-hour webinar on my discovery writing process that goes hand in hand with my research. So that will be like a webinar / mini course. You don't have to turn up live, you can listen to the replay, but that won't be sold anywhere else. That will be in my Kickstarter, and the pre-launch page is at jfpenn.com/destiny. Also, I clearly can't help myself. I have started on my next standalone novel, which we're going to call The Vineyard Book, for want of a working title. And of course, spring, summer, it's such a terrible time to be researching vineyards and English wine. So it's going to be a tough spring, summer. as I start researching that one. And I think it fits well with my research trips for Gothic cathedrals, which of course is a completely different vibe. Now, as again, I'm a discovery writer, I find story in place. So yeah, lots of book research trips coming up as the weather finally gets better here in the UK and the cycle of creativity turns again. I guess I'm in finishing energy for Spear of Destiny and I am in starting energy for these other projects. I also wanted to come clean. I said a couple of weeks ago that I intended to update Business for Authors, and then I had a realization that my whole thing at the end of 2023 was I'm pivoting into JF Penn. JF Penn does not write Business for Authors. JF Penn writes The Vineyard Book and The Gothic Cathedrals and all these other and pictures, movies. So yes, I'm not rewriting Business for Authors. I actually had a look at it as well, and it's pretty good. So that gets you 90% there, as far as I'm concerned. And what I am planning to do instead is I will do a solo episode in the next few months on some key business things you need to know. But to be honest, most of what I know is in Business for Authors, How to Make a Living with Your Writing, those two books mainly. Oh, and Your Author Business Plan. Those three books together, pretty blooming good. But yes, expect a solo episode on that. And so if you were someone who was listening and you were like, why is she talking about doing another edition of Business for Authors? That's by Joanna Penn. Well, there you go. And of course, sometimes when we do attempt to pivot, we kind of get tugged back to the old thing because in some ways it's easier to do the old thing, but it's like, nope, not going to do that. So yeah. Expect a solo episode instead. Okay, so thank you for your emails and comments and photos this week. Rosie Radcliffe on YouTube said on the bookmarketing episode, thank you. After years of hurling myself bodily at the gates of trad publishing, my first book will come out this year. I'm a total novice when it comes to self-publishing. The first thing I did was buy one of your books. So nice to hear an English voice when so much out there is American. Fantastic. And Brian on the marketing episode said, I'm surprised by how much I enjoy selling my books with reels. And if you don't know, reels are like short videos. I'm on TikTok and Instagram and they are a ton of fun. I love the editing, the creating and all things that go into it. I've learned if you find something you enjoy, keep doing it, which I think is so great. I think this is exactly the way it should be done. So Brian loves video and reels. I don't. I do audio. You must find what you love and then do that as part of your marketing. And Rob said, Joanna, your podcast is bad for my health. I listen while on my elliptical machine, but I constantly have to stop and take notes when you bring up an interesting point. I end up exercising 15 out of my allotted 60 minutes. Well, hello, Rob, on the elliptical. Kidding aside, I enjoyed your interview with Matthew and the demo video on your Patreon. It seemed targeted at people like me who know how to create meta ads but struggle with the right strategies. I look forward to giving Matthew's suggestions a try. So yes, that was the interview with Matthew J. Holmes a few weeks ago about using meta ads with AI images. Right, so please leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com. And if you can't find things, go to thecreativepen.com/podcast and you will find the various episodes linked there. Or on the YouTube channel, you can leave a comment. You can also message me on X at thecreativepen with a double N. Yes, I am active on X again. I'm treating it like an entirely new platform. So I'm not lamenting the old days. It is not Twitter to me. It is X. I'm just getting on with the new way. Giving up the old, like the BlackBerry dudes did not do. You can also email me, send me pictures of where you're listening, joanna@thecreativepen.com. I love to hear from you. It makes this more of a conversation. So this episode is sponsored by Draft2Digital, self-publishing with support. And this is, of course, one of the great reasons you might choose to publish through Draft2Digital, because they have a customer service team who can help you. And sometimes that's just what you need, because we know it can be complicated to understand all the details of self-publishing. So you can publish ebooks to all the big platforms as well as library systems. You can also publish print books and they can help you through that process too. They have formatting tools as well as an easy publishing system. Personally, I use Drafter Digital for my ebook distribution to Nook, library systems, and now even to Apple. And I also use their excellent payment splitting for my co-written book, The Relax Author with Mark Leslie Lefebvre, a great option if you're co-writing or doing anthologies, that kind of thing. There are no charges for formatting or updating your book. Drafter Digital take a distributor 10% of retail price on sale. No upsells, no service packages, no fees of any kind. Set your price to whatever you want, even free. Make as many changes as you want to your book. Update the cover, distribute it to any and every sales channel you want. It's your book, your choice, and your world. They also have marketing tools and promotional opportunities available. Drafter Digital says, your book is your priority. Our priority is you. We build tools and services that let you focus on writing while we take care of layout, publishing, distribution, print-on-demand paperbacks and more. Check them out at draft2digital.com. That's draft2digital.com. So this type of corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by my community at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thanks to the 19 new patrons who've joined this week, and thanks to everyone who've been supporting for months and years. You are all amazing. If you join the community, you get access to my backlist videos and audio covering topics on creativity and AI, tutorials, business, mindset and more. Last week, I included a video on how to structure your non-fiction book. And this week, I will share my materials from pitching Catacomb. In fact, they should be there after this goes out. My pitch deck slides and also my 3-page outline. Plus, you get access to the monthly Q&A where you can ask your questions, which is basically an extra solo show of 45 minutes to an hour every month. The Patreon is now a monthly subscription, the equivalent of buying me a black coffee a month or a couple of coffees if you're feeling generous. So if you get value from the show and you want more, come on over and join more than 1,000 authors. Join us at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview. Rachel Herron is the internationally best-selling author of more than 24 books, including thrillers, feminist romance, memoir and non-fiction about writing. She's the host of the Ink in Your Veins podcast, and her latest book is Unstuck, an audacious hunt for home and happiness. So welcome back to the show, Rachel.
I am so thrilled to be here with you, Joanna. Thank you for having me.
Oh, no. I'm excited to talk to you today. Now, you were last on the show in July 2023, not that long ago, talking about publishing options. So we're going to jump straight into the topic today. And I wanted to talk to you partly because you just did an episode on your podcast about 8 lessons learned from 8 years as a full-time author. Can you believe it's gone so fast?
No, I cannot. It's literally the blink of an eye. You know.
I do know. And I think that it is something maybe we'll circle back on how fast it comes. But one of the things I really noticed as I listened to that episode was how relaxed you seemed in your writing life. And you talk about leaping before the net appears. But this is super hard for people. So I wanted to start with this fear of the unknown. How did you overcome your fear of the unknown, both when you left your job and before you write each book?
I love this question. Thank you. Fear is something that is ever present for me. I do suffer a little bit of anxiety. I am not a cool, calm kind of person. I tend toward the worrying spectrum. But I have learned over the years that the best things I do are when I do this leap, when I do this jump into the unknown, and it is always scary. So we started writing about the same time. I think I started writing seriously about 2006. Mm. And then I sold my first book in 2008, and then I was able to leave my day job in 2016. So for 10 years, I wrote and I worked my day job, night job. I worked as 911 for the fire department. And it got to a point where I desperately wanted to leave my job and write full time. But I was making 6 figures as a 911 dispatcher, and I was only making about $30,000 as a writer per year. So it was a huge pay cut. So what we had to do was pay off all the debt, which we did over the course of those 10 years. And then I was able to make the leap. And I have never been more sick about anything. I remember going into my manager's office, and she hadn't seen it coming because it wasn't worth talking about before then. And I told her that I quit. And she was shocked, and she offered to keep me on as a consultant, like so she could pull me in for overtime kind of thing. And I said yes, because I was so scared. So really, I quit, but I didn't quit. I honestly had this backup thing that I only ever worked, I think I only worked one or two overtime shifts, and they just stressed me out so much I didn't do them anymore. But I was terrified that we would end up living under a bridge. I would make no money. We would lose the house. And in that case, there was a little, I had a cheat that, and that my mother-in-law got sick. And if I quit, I could be with her. I could spend more time with her. And shortly after I quit, I mentioned this on the show, my wife lost her job. And I am not sure that if I had still been working my job and she had lost her job, would I have had the bravery to quit, or would I have been scared and I would still be a 911 dispatcher? I don't know. But one of the things that I think about with fear, and I deal with this whenever I'm facing something big, including being scared to write a new book or being scared to get the book right, is that I do know that leaping into the unknown is always scary. And I feel like sometimes, I feel like I used to think that if I were braver, if I had more courage, then it wouldn't feel that scary. But in my case, and I think in the case of many people, it's we don't overcome fear. We don't just talk our way out of it and then feel better about it. We just learn to live with the fear. And it's okay that it's there. I appreciate fear. I sometimes think of fear as this entity, this part of me, like Fearful Rachel. And Fearful Rachel does a really great job, and I appreciate her. She is the one that keeps me from eating expired meat and stepping in front of buses and taking off my clothes in inappropriate places. You know, that's Fearful Rachel pays the bills. She makes sure the lights stay on. She makes sure that I work hard enough to bring in X, Y, and Z. But she doesn't get to drive everything. She gets to have a say in some things, and she's not always right. So I like to thank that little fear, or the big fear, for keeping me safe. And then a couple of things that I've done in the past to combat fear. I've had a dedicated worry time and a worry journal that I can only write in at a certain time. Like, yes, 7:15 p.m. is when I go into my office and I write for 10 minutes about what I'm scared of. And when I've been in times of my life where I wake up at 2 in the morning and I can't sleep because of fear, I do that. And then specifically, so as you know, we took this big jump and we moved from the United States to New Zealand almost 3 years ago. And it's truly the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. And I was so scared. Tim Ferriss, you know who he is. He has a podcast and he was talking about his fear setting exercise. Have you ever heard of this?
I have, but explain it to people.
Yeah. So he does this fear setting exercise where for the big things, he sits down with a notebook and he writes about the things that scare him. And specifically, I have this right in front of me. You ask yourself, what if I blank? What if I move? What if I leave everyone I know and love, all my family and all my friends behind and move to New Zealand? So you write down the what if, and then you write down every single fear that scares you the most. And then that's in one column. And in another column, you write down the prevention for that fear. And then if it happens, in the third column, you write down how to repair it. And I did this when we were moving to New Zealand. And I learned that there were some things that I couldn't fix. Like one of my biggest fears was that someone I loved would get sick or hurt and I wouldn't be able to get back to the States in time to say goodbye to them. And I remember sitting with this piece of paper and thinking, how do I prevent this? Okay, there's got to be a way because Tim Ferriss said there would be a way. And there wasn't. But what I put in that column was, I will always have enough money in the bank to get the first flight out to get to the States. And then under repair, there is no repair, but I can also stay in very close contact with the ones that I love. And I'm looking at the page here. I had 22 massive fears from like, what if we get a divorce? What if we get sick and have no friends? And I filled out the prevention and the repair columns, and it made me feel so much better to have kind of externalized all those worries. And then the last thing I'll say about fear is that he says, you ask yourself, what might be the benefits of an attempt or a partial success, and then you rate that 1 to 10. And what's the cost if I don't do this thing that I'm scared of? And then you rate that 1 to 10. And for moving to New Zealand, the benefits were huge. We would see more of the world. We would travel. Choices are endless. And that got a 10. But the cost of inaction, staying in Oakland with a mortgage we couldn't pay off before we retire, not having good health care in the United States, that got a 2 or a 3. So let's go. And actually, and I know that for writers, sometimes putting that kind of thing on paper can help a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're right. We did start around the same time, 2006. And that was when the 4-hour work week came out.
Yeah,
and I'm pretty sure that is in that book.
Oh, I bet it is. He has I know it from a TED talk that he did on it, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it's in that book because I remember it's the what if I'm homeless and I'm living in a caravan by the stream or something like that, or a tent by a stream, and what if I lose everything? And I think everything you said there is amazing. But I do want to just talk about the fear of unknown with a book. So although both you and I have moved around the world to change our lives and quit jobs, a lot of people have this fear of unknown around a book. Because when we sit down to write a book, whether it's the first book or even like you and I right now and this new book, Unstuck, and what you're doing with this book, we don't know the outcome. We don't know whether anyone's going to like it. We don't, like, if you want to sell to traditional publishing, you don't know if you'll get a deal. If you do, maybe it will flop. I mean, there's a whole load of fear of the unknown around writing a book. Can we even finish the book? How do we do everything? And I feel like a lot of the fear for authors, and I'm sure you get all these emails as well, people are obsessed with, oh, well, how do I publish properly? How do I market when they haven't even finished a first draft a lot of the time? But, and I think that's trying to control the fear of the unknown. So can you just talk a little bit about this fear of the unknown with writing a book and how we can trust that something will emerge in that way?
Yeah. And that's so real. And it's hard to have that trust that something will emerge when you haven't gone through the thing before, right? Well, after you have a few books under your belt, you trust that you will get there. But in those first few books, I understand how scary that is. I love what Becca Syme, I loved hearing her on your show pretty recently, but I love that she always says, most of us want more clarity than we can ever have. So again, it's getting more comfortable with this discomfort in making these huge decisions. And you're right, it is fear that makes us ask, is this marketable? Will people buy this? Will people get mad at me for writing this? That's all fear. And so what I like to remember when I am scared to move in the direction of a book is that there is no right or wrong. And that sounds so easy and light, but there really truly is no right or wrong. What we do have to do is make a decision. And for a lot of us who are overthinkers, shall we put it, we could think forever. We could think forever. And my brain loves thinking so much that I will ask it to think and it will say, great, I'm going to think for a while. And then it will give me a great answer. It'll give me a 100%. We're going to go this way. We're going to write paranormal women's fiction next. Perfect. And then about 18 hours later, my stupid soul will ask my brain, hey, do you want to think about that again? And my brain will say, yes, I would love to think about it again. And the thing about our brains is that they're so beautiful and so strong that they not only will they think about it all over again, but they will come up with a different, better for now answer. And they will do that for the next 10 years and you won't write your book. So for me, I have to kind of put a time box around a decision window. When I know, I have to notice I'm doing it. But when I notice I'm waffling, I will say, okay, on Monday, I literally do this. On Monday afternoon from 4 p.m. till 4:15, I'm going to sit down with my journal and I'm going to make a decision on the thing I can't decide about. And after 4:15, I cannot change my mind. And the beautiful thing about this is that we can't make, there is no right or wrong, but we can make the decision that we make right. So somebody said this and I can't remember who, but don't make the right decision, make the decision right. So it almost doesn't matter what book I choose to write at 4:15, because I've made the decision and now I'm moving forward. Now I have a direction and I can give fear a different job. Will I be able to pull this off? Will I get a good plot? How am I going to dial in the characters the way I want? Fear can do something else, but fear doesn't get to keep worrying about, should it be a 6-book series or a 9-book series? No, it just needs to be a book first. So I make a time box around the window for decision-making time, and then I just move forward, being comfortable with that discomfort. And another thing I just want to say really quickly about fear as we're talking about it, we can talk about this and it's fantastic, but I will also say that if fear is a generalized anxiety disorder or a trauma response that you need help with, it's great to do all these things that you and I are talking about, to journal and talk to friends and whatever it is that helps, but also it's really great to go to a therapist and work through the things that you may need bigger help with in order to get unstuck.
Yes, for sure. But we're going to assume that this is a different conversation. Yeah, this isn't specifically about the trauma side. Yeah, I mean, I think moving forward is really important. I feel like the circling and not moving forward is the struggle sometimes. And I know that's hard for people. But as you say, I mean, you take an action. And then, I mean, I've talked before about skiing down a hill. I don't do much skiing anymore, but you know, you want to go down the hill, but you don't just go in a straight line. You head off in one direction and then you zigzag back in the other direction, and then maybe you fall over and then you zigzag back the other way, and there is no straight path to
I love that
but we but have the, to what you want to do.
But the one thing you have done is you've decided which side of the mountain you're going to go down. You can't and you're not going up the mountain. When you are skiing down and zigzagging, you're still going towards that.
Yeah, you've chosen the direction.
You've chosen the direction. Yeah, I love that analogy. That's perfect.
Mm. Okay, so let's come back to, because so obviously you journal a lot, you write a lot, but I think you do have a gift for writing memoir. And obviously you've spent a lot of time writing this stuff, so you've had a deliberate practice. You weren't born with it necessarily, but you are able to write in a real emotionally honest way regularly. You know, I'm part of your Patreon and you send out essays, and you recently wrote about building this Adirondack chair, which I thought was lovely. And I wondered about your process. So you've mentioned journaling, but what is your process for writing essays, personal essays and memoir, which you often collect and put into books? And how does that differ from your fiction?
I love that this whole conversation is really about fear. And when we're talking about writing personal narrative of any sort, whether it's an entire memoir like you have done, or even just a personal essay that you're going to put somewhere in the world, there's just this huge level of fear. Because when we are writers and we put out any kind of writing, we know that we're putting our soul on display, but especially so when we're talking about our real selves. So first, the number one thing I do when I'm writing something, a first draft, is I'm quite gullible. I tell myself that no one will ever see it, and I kind of make myself believe it, even though now I've done it long enough that I'm like, yeah, Rachel, you're gonna polish this and put it out somewhere. But I do tell myself that it will never escape my computer, or if you're writing in a journal, it'll never escape the journal. And I make myself tell the truest draft. And that's really, really hard, because it's a natural state of affairs to want to present ourselves in a good light. Like right now when I'm talking to you, and I know how many people listen to your show, I'm trying not to stutter or mispronounce words because I'm trying to appear semi-cool. And it's hard when you're writing narrative nonfiction to not... To actually put yourself out there, warts and all, with all of our flaws, all of our true flaws. So that's why in that first draft, I try to tell the truest, the darkest, the hardest parts, the places where I suck the most. And I always encourage people, if they're doing this, every computer you can password protect. Even just a document. You can leave your whole computer open for your kids or your husband or whoever, but you can password protect that one document, so that you know that nobody could ever see it. If you were, God forbid, hit by a truck, no one's ever going to find it. So do that in a first draft if this is something that makes you fearful. And then here's the tip. You would expect me to say, and then you revise it and you make it into what you want it to be. But instead, especially if people are new to this and it's personal memoir, when you go back to reread whatever it is that you wrote, a thing that can be super useful is to circle or highlight the 2 or 3 sentences that make you cringe the most, that make you feel the most uncomfortable. And then instead of deleting those, because that's the obvious thing you want to do, you highlight them. You go back and ask yourself, Why am I uncomfortable? Are they so true that it's making me squirm? Or are they a little bit untrue and I actually need to be more truthful? The thing that we have to remember is that readers don't ever judge us for being flawed and human. They judge us for not being that way. Mm. But if we talk about our damage, our wounds, and we talk about the stupid things we do because we're just humans, readers lean in and they empathize and they cheer for us and they want to be there for us.
That is such a great tip. I love that. That is so valuable that you go through your draft and you circle the things that are like almost too much. And actually, Neil Gaiman has a quote, doesn't he? Or something like, when you feel like you're walking down the road naked or something, then you're getting to the heart of it. And that's basically what you're saying. It's like, if I put this sentence into the world, and this is fear of judgment, which yes. I definitely struggle with, which is, what are people going to think of me? And yes, people may think something of you, but as yeah. you said, generally they're going to feel themselves. They're going to feel seen. They're going to be like, oh my goodness, that happened to me. Or I understand how that feels. And that's why they resonate with your work. And that's why memoir is so powerful. So I really, yeah. I love that tip. I wonder then, with your fiction, do you take these emotional cores and build from that? Or do they emerge in your fiction as well?
I think that they emerge naturally. I think that as a writer, and this probably varies from person to person, but I think I'm just braver with giving my characters big and real flaws because I do know that I'm making them up. And if anyone said, hey, Rachel, is that you on the page? I could say, no, I made that up. I'm better than that, even though it's not true. But it is still the same thing that when I write the thing that makes me uncomfortable, when a character says something that I go, Do I want to put that on the page? That is always an arrow that is either pointing, no, it's almost always pointing to gold, honestly. And I learned this when I wrote A Life in Stitches. My editor was Jennifer Traeg, who is a phenomenal memoir writer. She wrote The Devil in the Details and a bunch of others. And I remember writing these essays for Life in Stitches and sending them to her as I went. And I would be so proud of these pieces. And then she would basically, I'm not exaggerating, X out most of what I had sent her, and she would always hone in on the one or two sentences that I had not felt comfortable with. And then she said, I don't care about the rest, go here. Mm. And I think if we have that in mind while we're creating our characters or while we're writing our characters, how can they be truly flawed? It makes writing fiction so fun. And I know that writers fear, you know, going back to fear, writers fear that our readers are not going to like the main character. They're going to be unsympathetic if we make them flawed and real. But I've almost never found that to be the case. And if they did come off a little bit really unlikable, that's an editor's job. I also like to leave my editors a job to do. And the editor can say, I'm not feeling this. Why don't you change this? But making them as real as possible is, and emotionally, especially showing them with those flaws is beautiful. And that's what I love to read. I love to read characters in novels that make me feel like I'm not alone.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
And that is it, isn't it? That's what we all look for in, well, one of the things we look for in reading is certainly to feel that way. And I think with memoir, a lot of it is hope, I think, a transformation, seeing someone else's life transformation in some way. And that can help you in your own life. But I wanted to come back to the chair. So you made this chair and you made it with your hands. And it's so interesting because I have booked myself on a stone carving weekend. And of course, it's research for a book because I want to write about a stonemason, but which of course is completely random. But I wondered about this analog experience. So, because I've been thinking about this, and I know your business as well is mostly online, but these analog physical experiences are becoming, I think, important in this digital age. Mm-hmm. And with the rise of AI, and we both use AI in different ways as part of our tools, we think it's a tool, but it is changing the digital space. And there's part of me that is feeling like I need to incorporate more physical, live person things into my business. But I'm also afraid, since we're using fear as the most of this episode, is my energy, because I find it hard. But also hard is sometimes a good thing, and I should push myself into doing hard things. But also, let's face it, the profit is usually bigger on digital things. So I wondered how you're thinking about this and kind of incorporate that into how you're doing streams of income and all of this kind of thing.
Oh, this is so good. So the experiences that we're talking about, these physical making experiences, I absolutely love that you're doing the stone carving, and I cannot wait to see pictures on your Instagram about this. The Adirondack chair building course was so unpleasant in so many ways. I absolutely hated it so much until I really gathered this beginner's mind and just decided that on the third night of, like, I was in the bathroom crying because I'd cut the wrong piece of wood and now I didn't have enough wood to make the backslats. It was awful. And I knew I'd have to go back to the hardware store. But then I just decided, look, I'm never going to sell Adirondack chairs as a business. This is not going to be my profession. I don't have to be perfect at this. And I just decided that I would ask for help and I would go talk to the teacher every single time I got confused, which was a lot. I've never done anything like this. And he would help me. And that's where the class really got fun, because it put me in connection with him and with my classmates and asking them for help. And then they would come and ask me for help, which was really weird because I barely knew what I was doing. But when I think about this, we've been staring at computers for like 30 odd years of the last 200,000 years of human evolution, right? Mm-hmm. And up until the Industrial Revolution, every single thing we owned or used had to be made by hand by someone. So we always knew someone who could make everything around us, and we were all makers. It's in our bones and our DNA to make. But even more than that, I think it's in our DNA to feel connected while doing the making. Like, I'm also undertaking sourdough right now, and I'm in communication with a lot of, I know I'm the very last on the block, but with a lot of other people who are talking about this and doing it next to each other. I think about, so my sisters and I have two sisters, and one just moved to New Zealand not long ago, but the three of us, we get together on Zoom a lot, and we never hang out on Zoom and just talk, like stare at the computer like we're in a meeting. We do things. Christy will be mending trousers. I'll be making granola. Bethany will be knitting. And then we'll move around the house and we'll take the computers with us. We're always doing something. And I think that that's how we all lived for so long, is when we made things, when we did things, we did them in community. And that's how we built community, was all of that beautiful conversation that happens while we are doing other things. And I think it's sitting alone and writing is the polar opposite of how humans evolved. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not what we've always done. And even letter writing in the past was still a direct connection. It was a call and response. If I was writing a letter to somebody, I was thinking about them constantly, responding to what they had said in a letter, and then they do the same thing and send it back. So us writing into the void is such a different experience that I think that that's why this physical hands-on making is something that can, yes, be very frustrating if we don't know what we're doing, but it also soothes us. It makes us feel very, very human. And so to your question, which I just think is so such a good one to think about, is that in our author business, it's so, I don't know about you, but it's so easy for me to just get lost in the computer and lost in my thoughts and plans and worries and what am I going to do next and looking at my to-do list. But to come back to thinking about it, like when I'm knitting socks on Zoom with my sisters, what is the connection? What am I trying to do with my writing? Almost all of the people who listen to your podcast and almost all of the people who listen to my podcast are writers. There are some people who are not, for whatever reason, but most of them are writers. And almost none of them are writers who only want to journal and then burn the pages. I am sure that there are two or three people who want to do that. But most of the people who listen to these shows are writers who want to meaningfully connect at some point in some fashion. So when I'm writing, I need to think about who I'm connecting with And usually I make that into a specific person. At sometimes it's been this, my ideal reader, whose name is Laura Jean. She's a real person. She loves my books and she's been a beta reader for me a couple of times. And sometimes I'm writing to her, but more often I'm writing to me. I'm writing to myself in a different version, in a different universe, at a different age. What I want to write is what would please me so much if I found this book that I wouldn't want to get out of bed because I'd want to hang out with this exact person. I'd want to hang out with this Rachel. Then I write that. So what I think about is using writing to connect to ourselves. And when we connect to ourselves in that really deep way, then we're going to connect with others. And on top of that, I do think that there is so much use for actual community in whatever way that best suits you, which sometimes is not what I want. I know that I don't want to go to writers groups. And when I do, oh my gosh, I'm so full when I leave. When I go to my RWNZ group, I don't want to go. I've got a bunch of other things I want to do. But if I hang out with people who are thinking about the same things that I am, it just feels good.
I find it interesting because I always think about doing more in-person events. I keep getting emails from people who came to my full-day workshop here in Bath last year. And I guess I'm thinking, oh, maybe I could do another one. And yet I know how tiring it is. And yet also it's so tiring in a good way. And like planning on going to Las Vegas to Author Nation. And again, it's a challenge to do these in-person things, but there's so much benefit from doing it. But you have this Rachel Says Write thing where on Zoom and like you're writing and other people turn up and write. And I just think that's absolutely crazy. I can't imagine anything worse. And that's just weird. And yet presumably people love it and you presumably like it because you keep doing it.
That's such a good quit. That's such a good point because I don't like it. I love it. I love
it. That's so weird.
But here's the thing. Like it takes a lot of energy to be on a call of any kind, Zoom of any kind, but not this because what we do is we talk for like, and by we, I mean, I give them a quote and I ask how they're doing and they type it in the chat. And then for 2 hours, we're silent. And then at the very end, we get back in and we say how it went. But for some reason, and I'm not looking at the screen. If I go over to the screen, I love to see their thinking faces. And I know that my thinking face is just bananas. But usually we're not. We're just looking at our work. And knowing that other people are writing at the same time is so cool. It makes me work, which is so dumb because they don't know what I'm looking at. I could be looking at Facebook for all they know.
You could be doing email or whatever.
I could be putting my screen off and making phone calls, but I'm not. We actually write. And it's been so cool and so popular that I used to charge $39 a month for it. And I'm, again, taking a little bit of a pay cut because I want more people to do it. So I just opened it up to $2 at the Patreon level. And so many people are joining. It's so fun. Okay, so that is one of my favorite connections. Apparently, I got really excited just to think about it. But it wouldn't be your way.
No, I'm not doing that, by the way. Anyone listening, I am not doing that.
I will say that I do, in terms of like neurocognitive differences, I do have ADHD and body doubling is a thing that a lot of ADHD people work better if they know that somebody is doing the same thing at the same time.
Interesting.
I do attract some neurospicy people and we do that together. Yeah.
I like neurospicy. That's awesome. Well, let's talk about another fear, which is your first Kickstarter launches today. As we record this, it still hasn't quite yet gone live, but it will be live when this episode goes out. And I remember how absolutely terrified I was before pressing the button. There's like literally a button to press. But you've launched so many books. You've done traditionally published books. You've done indie. You've done a lot of launches. So how are you feeling and how has this process pushed you more than normal?
I've been terrified. It's not a bigger project than I thought it would be because people like you have been really clear, you and Monica, and you've been really clear. This is a huge thing. This is not a small thing. Don't expect to do this in a weekend or a couple of afternoons. But I thought it was cool. And then this morning I woke up and I was going to go hit the live button and my finger literally was on the button. And then this thought floated through my head that said, I put everything in this in US dollars, but what if it's actually New Zealand dollars? Because I know on the preview page, it shows New Zealand dollars it default to where I am.
Just explain why that's an issue in terms of the currency.
Because the New Zealand dollar is probably about 61 cents to the American dollar. So yeah. I have this desperate email out to Kickstarter. They're off today because it's a holiday, but hopefully they'll get back to tomorrow and I'll hit the button because everything is lined up to go. Today was the day. But if that went through, it would be such a major error. It would basically be like saying, if I'm planning for 1/3 profit, hopefully, I just cut my profit by 1/3 plus shipping that I've now put in the wrong currency too. I would end up, no matter what kind of book I sold, I would end up paying for it. I would pay for every single thing that left the Kickstarter.
That's a pretty big possible mistake.
My heart rate went through the roof. I screamed and my wife ran in like, is it okay? I'm like, I don't know if it's okay. But I haven't felt this kind of fear around a launch in many, many years. And I think it's feeling like the fear is bigger because I know that for Kickstarter, you've got to push it. Like there is, I actually have to do promotion. And I like so many writers, I hate promotion. And so much of the planning for the Kickstarter has gone into things like planning the emails, planning the social media, planning the extra podcasts that I'm going to put out, planning Patreon posts. And I'm much more comfortable pushing a book out. And if it's a self-published book, I like to send one or two, like I send one email and then maybe a couple of weeks later I send a second email and I'm done. And with traditionally published books, I don't do much more than that either. So doing a Kickstarter, I think, has made me have to trust myself more that I'll really act like a business person instead of a writer who likes to do a little business. Like this is serious. This is how I am. And I'm really serious about this book. This is a book that I did not offer to my agent. I love this book. I want to get it on the world. It's going to be Kickstarter and then it'll be on my Shopify for a month exclusively. And then it will go wide. So I have all the plans in place, but I didn't know I would be this nervous.
I mean, I really felt that, having done two now, but also with more coming, that it's a worthwhile push and that actually this is really good for us. And we had got, in fact, talking about unstuck, I feel like we had been stuck in our processes. And like you said, we've been doing this, I guess, almost 20 years now since we started doing this, writing for publication and being serious about a career. And I feel like, oh my goodness, I had been stuck in my ways. And I'd been stuck in the way I use social media. I've been stuck in the way I just did email. All of these things we can easily, if we just repeat the same thing over and over again, we can become stuck in that. Yes. So I feel like the Kickstarter process is kicking us out of that. So what are some of the things you're doing for this Kickstarter that you haven't done before in terms of marketing? Or are you just doing a lot more in the period?
I'm doing a lot more in the period, but what you say is exactly right. I think that I've just gotten complacent. And that's not a good place to be. This is, for me, that's not a good place to be. I do need to be pushing myself. And this feels like an external push that I am choosing that will be hard to do and also so worthwhile. It's making me believe, on one hand, it's making me believe in myself. And on the other hand, I think the fear comes from, I'm just scared that I will totally fail. I will either not hit my goal, which is very low, or that I'll screw up all of the money. And like your biggest fear is everybody says, do the shipping, make sure the all of the numbers are right. And what if you do that in the wrong currency? Like there are fears I didn't even know to have, and I could screw this up so badly. And no one likes that. No one likes the fear of abject failure. So it is reminding me, what I like about it is it's reminding me again to face it and go, this is uncomfortable and it's not going to kill me. This is good for me. And I can almost sometimes enjoy that discomfort if I think about it that way.
So tell us about Unstuck, your book, and also what people can find in the Kickstarter.
Thank you. You can find it at rachelherron.com, Unstuck, or you can just Google Kickstarter Unstuck. I think it's the second one that comes up. It'll be obvious. But it is the memoir about every step of the way from the moment that my wife and I decided mid-pandemic that we would move to New Zealand kind of out of the blue. We never really thought we would do this. And then we decided and we went. And it's every step from selling everything we owned, selling the house, moving very quickly because of reasons. We were gone 4 months after we really made the decision. And then moving to this new country and finding a home because we didn't know where to live and finding friends because we didn't have any friends. And it's the whole exploration of that. And in the Kickstarter, there is obviously the normal things, the ebook and the paperback and the hardcover. But there's the thing I'm most excited about is that the Kickstarter is allowing me to have the time to do the audio. And I love doing and producing audiobooks. This will be my third. And it's one of my passions. Mm. Also, in terms of perks over there, there's an online writing retreat. And there is coaching with me, which is something I probably haven't done in 5 years. There's actual coaching. And then there's other fun add-ons, like other books I've written and signed things and fun things.
Ooh, that sounds
I get
good.
So nervous just thinking about it.
So you narrate the audiobook?
Yes, yes. Yep.
Oh, fantastic. And it's interesting you say that you really enjoy that because a lot of people, it is hard narrating an audiobook, yeah. But you really enjoy that.
I love everything about it except the editing, which because it just always takes longer than you think it will. Mm. But you were the one who turned me on to Hindenburg, which is just the best program ever. I absolutely love Hindenburg. It just makes a lot of things easier. And because we've been at this game a long time, it's just so nice to get the tools that we've always wanted. I remember when we had to code EPUBs and it was terrible. So now when the tools roll out, we use them. And yes, but yes, I love doing the audio. It's a thrill.
That's awesome. That is Hindenburg Narrator for everyone. I'll put that in the show notes. Okay, so where else can people find you and everything you do online and your podcast?
Thank you. The podcast is, it is formerly How Do You Write? And now it is called Ink in Your Veins, because I think we do all have ink in our veins or we would not continue doing this. And if you're a writer, you may want to get on my writer's email list because I try to give away everything that I know. And that's over at rachelherron.com/write. And if people are interested in the Rachel Says Write, where we just write together for 2 to 8 hours a week, that's at patreon.com/Rachel, RACHAEL. And thank you so much for letting me talk to you about all this stuff, especially the scary stuff, Joe.
Oh, no. Thanks for coming on.
So I hope you found the discussion with Rachel interesting and that it helps you face your fears, whatever they relate to. Let me know what you think about the interview or about your comments on my pitching experience or my questions that I posed around the BlackBerry movie. You can leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com or on the YouTube channel or message me on X at thecreativepen or email me joanna@thecreativepen.com. So next week, I'm talking to Tristra New Year Jaeger about generative AI impact on creativity and business in the music industry. Yes, we're going to the music industry, as well as we talk about aspects of creator economy and having fun with our creativity. So in the meantime, happy writing, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.